6 on 2FM.
Well, a big thank you to the two Johnnies for keeping us entertained this afternoon. It is Tuesday, the 2nd of May, and you're listening to Game On. Coming up this evening, Tim Clancy has gone from St. Pat's, and is Big Sam going to Leeds? We'll find out the latest from Alan Colley and Mark Langdon, as well as the rest of the day's association football news, including Arsenal beat Chelsea tonight in the English Premier League.
Well, when you have someone who keeps calling soccer association football, it's no wonder we got run away with ourselves last night and never got near the rugby. So Ian Keatley has kindly joined to come on again this evening, where he will reflect on the weekend's Champions Cup rugby as La Rochelle aim to halt Leinster's drive for five again.
Indeed, we'll be chatting rugby football, Ruby. Plus in Gaelic football, we've Damien Lawler on today's group stage draw for both the Sam Maguire and Tailteann Cup. If you want to get in touch, text us on 51552 or tweet us at Game On 2FM.
Game on 2FM.
Ruby Walsh, what's the official name for horse racing? Is it just horse racing, or is there any other terminology?
It's horse racing, yeah. Okay. It's pretty straightforward. You do have national hunt flat racing, or national hunt horse racing, and flat horse racing, but it's fairly straightforward, yeah.
Okay, that's fine.
Well, the associated bodies that run them, they get really complicated, and it's how many letters can you fit in one sentence to probably balance half them up. But other than that, no, it's fairly straightforward.
Okay. That's good. I just seeing if there's any traditional names that I might allude to horse racing going forward, you know, with rugby union and association football and everything else. And snooker as well. There's Alan Colley has a...
You're going to tell me there's something, some mad title to go with snooker as well, is there?
No, I think... Do you know the origins of snooker?
Fairly straightforward as well, snooker.
Yeah, I think it comes from...
Billiards or something linked with the billiards.
From China. Didn't Sean Murphy... We're getting off to a first tangent here with 5 minutes in the show, but Sean Murphy, I think it came from China, and it was a nickname as well for the sport as well. 51552, if any snooker anoraks out there can tell us where the name came from. But
come on, Colley, you're the snooker anorak, surely you know.
I actually don't know the origins, no, but something I probably should look into, Ruby, yeah, to be honest with you. Consider
what about the origin of Luca Brazzell's victory then? Start there.
Oh. Yeah, absolutely brilliant, Ruby. I'm a big fan of Selby, but to be fair to Brazzell, and when you think of his previous record at the championships, I think his previous five appearances, he's never got past the first round, Luca Brazzell, which is a major surprise to people considering the talent that he has. But talent always doesn't get you as far as you want in sport, and the question mark over Luca Brazzell, the talent was always there, was the application, because everybody knew how good he was for a long time now. But he put it all together this year, Ruby, and he got through his first round, and then obviously he beat Mark Williams, and he beat Ronnie O'Sullivan, beat Mark Selby, so he's done it the hard way to win the tournament. And it was expected when people saw him playing years ago, in terms of when he first burst on the scene, because of the talent that he had. But as the years have gone by, the harder it gets. But if he applied himself properly over the years, I think we would have seen him win a world title before now.
I did enjoy that. I was reading the report on it, and it was all the more remarkable to win in the context of Brazzell's claims that he'd come into the tournament and squeezed past Ricky Walden in a final frame decider in the opening round, fueled by games of darts and drinking binges.
That's the thing. And even it was who was I listening to during the week? Stephen Hendry, actually, during the final in one of the between the frames, and I think it was after one of the sessions, I think it could have been the second or third session, and they asked Stephen Hendry how should he go off and relax for the next 3 or 4 hours before the evening session, and I think he had built up the lead as well, and Stephen Hendry was given the typical professional advice, you know, go home, go back to the hotel, chill out, relax, ignore everyone. But he said Luca Brazzell has been doing the complete opposite throughout the tournament, and he's been in and around the bar and staying up till after midnight chatting away to everyone. He wasn't
during the tournament.
During the tournament. Wow. Yeah, and just being so relaxed and approaching it. And it's interesting when you think about that, like so many sports people get so worked up about obviously the actual game or the match or whatever the case may be, whatever the event is, and here's a lad who just did it the complete opposite, went against all the kind of advice that you'd get from a psychologist and everything. And he's just approaching it as if it's just another tip around or whatever, and obviously it's worked for him. So it doesn't always work for everybody, but it's absolutely worked for Luca Brazzell.
But that is the theory of it. I mean, it's a table with however many balls on it. It's the very same in a snooker club on a Monday night as it is in the Crucible on the Monday night of the World Championship final. It's the very same table, same balls. It's the same thing if you can keep your mindset that way. So maybe not putting yourself in an alien environment, like being alone in your hotel room, whilst you might be supposed to be relaxed, but surely, Alan Colley, that gives most people far too much time to think.
Yeah, and that's exactly, that would be the worry I would have about locking yourself away in a bedroom, is because you'd be thinking non-stop about it. Whereas if you're surrounding yourself with people and can distract yourself in some way and chatting to people or whatever and take your mind off what's about to kind of, what you're about to embark on for the next 4 or 5 hours that could change your life, brilliant. But it's a lot easier said than done, Ruby. And the way you were describing it there about like, oh, it's just another table on a Monday night, like down at the club, you throw in 900 people, 1,000 people, the millions that are watching on TV, what it means back home to the country, it's very, very hard to not to separate yourself from that. And I suppose,
but
to be fair,
but that is the trick. You can't see the millions for a start.
Yeah.
Right, the cameras are there, but now if you can see down the camera and see the millions, you're a much better person than me. But you can't see the millions. Mm-hmm. So what you have is the people in the auditorium. Mm-hmm. But if you're looking at the people in the auditorium, you're not concentrating.
No, 100%. And that's all he would have been doing, was concentrating on the table, as you say, like the way you've put it, that it's just another table. But it just sounds a lot easier the way you're describing it than actual. I could only imagine how nervous and how...
But it's not a sport that you feed off that. Like, say in perhaps football or rugby, you're getting G'd up by the crowd and you're feeding off that energy. Whereas in snooker, you're more, you know, it's more tactical, it's more...
Yeah, but Shane, you could have, in the intimacy of that arena, the smallest little thing will distract you, because you're zoned in terms of concentration. That environment that's played in a silent environment, obviously it's different from football, where obviously it's roaring and shouting and you're feeding off that. But the slightest little twitch of somebody in the crowd, a wrapping paper, a lad that gets up, you see them going off the other table during the interval and people walking off. I've seen it myself at the tournament. The slightest little thing will put them off. That's why you see them getting up off the shot, because they're so in tune. And then what you don't see on the TV as well, when you're actually there, the camera is so close to the pocket, they actually miss a lot more when you're there, amazingly enough. On TV, they make it look like they're potting everything. But believe me, the tension in that room, I've said this to you more times, we've had more chats about this, the atmosphere at the snooker in the Crucible is the best I've ever seen. It's incredible. For all those reasons, opposite to a football match, say, because it's so silent. It's just, it's like being in a library and hearing everything.
But no matter what, how quiet it is or how much you're looking, what you can't see is what's going on between somebody's ears and the consequences. If I miss this instead of when this goes in, you can't see that train of thought, Alan.
No, and the way we're saying it there about Purcell being so calm and approached it in the manner that he did, and that's his demeanour anyway. He's kind of happy-go-lucky, seems like, whatever, kind of fly-by-the-seat-of-your-pants type lad, and this is just whatever the world, even though for us, but it's like, and that's why psychology is amazing in sport, because we're describing it here as if, oh sure, everybody should do that.
Wait, were you able to do that? You're two sports men.
I never really got nervous before a match, but I used to always think the nights I got nervous, you knew it was something was riding on it and it was a big match. And I always thought that was a good thing, because to me, I'm not sure what Ruby thinks, the nerves made you concentrate that bit more, I found.
Yeah, I love nerves as well, and I did get nervous before big meetings, big race meetings, especially big meetings. So the build up, and actually the older I got, the less I enjoyed the night before, the day, even the Monday at Cheltenham, like, it was the longest day of the year. But I loved the taking part. I ended up hating the night before and the morning of, but I enjoyed the riding part. But once I got on the horse, to me that was all gone, and there was no nerves, and it didn't matter where you were, how many people were there. And my biggest flaw, Shane, is I was probably too positive. I never thought about what if this doesn't go right. I was just always this is going right.
The night before, Ruby, would you surround yourself with family or would you kind of hide away from
people? The same people all the time. Gillian, David Casey and his wife Anya, James Nash, it's the same people all the time. Dad wouldn't have ever been too far away, but same people, and keep it normal, keep the same thing, go so for dinner.
Yeah, so if you're having dinner, would the conversation just be like as if you were just out on a normal night?
Oh yeah,
just keep it like that.
Anything.
You'd want to switch off though, wouldn't you? Like, you'd want that just...
Yeah, they were my friends, so I kept it that way. And you were in an individual sport, so you weren't like a snooker player, I suppose. You're not part of a team, or you're at a team dinner and you're going through team tactics. This was all my tactics in my head, and I probably didn't want to talk to anybody about tactics anyway. I had my own decision made and my own mind made up, and I was doing what I wanted to do, so please don't confuse me.
why was it more difficult the older you got? Surely with the experience you're more used to it now?
The pressure of expectation.
Okay. Okay. That's
And did you find, Ruby, like, we've seen the dynamic change over the years, say, to when you were first on the scene and then the Paul Nicholls years, and then you get to Willie, who's winning everything. So the expectation was only increased as you were getting older because of Willie's dominance here.
Yeah, that was it. You were like, it was the pressure of expectation. I was a complete realist, so I knew what chance you had of winning. Like, you were, if you were lucky in Cheltenham, you were going to ride at a... Like, if you had been over Cheltenham, you were riding at a 17-18% strike rate. Like, that was some Cheltenham.
Yeah.
But, like, you're listening to people, reading the papers, you think you were going to ride everywhere. So the pressure of expectation, yeah, that's what it was. That's what I didn't enjoy in the end.
Well, you were half decent, Ruby, to be fair now. You did write quite a few winners.
That narrative, Ruby, like, because Cheltenham's gone so big and we've the preview nights and there seems to be one on every second night in the lead up and you could have 10, 12 preview nights and the discussion on social media and at the races and all these channels. Did you used to hide away from those discussions when, as you say, literally everybody was tipping Willies to win every race?
I wasn't for that reason. I didn't go because I had my own opinion as to what I would fancy in a race, how a race would shape up, tactics, etc. So if I went to all those preview nights, Alan, and read all the papers and listened to everything that was going on, I'd be at the start and I'd be giving horses a chance that I thought had no chance.
Yeah.
So I just kept to myself and did what I believed in, because I don't mind being wrong myself, but I hated being wrong because I'd listened to somebody else. I wanted all the blame. I wanted to be all right or all wrong. I wanted to be on my terms. And that's the way I was.
You had the blinkers on, Ruby.
Basically, yeah. I find it easier, Ruby, to be wrong myself than be wrong having listened to somebody else.
I know we always talk about you a lot, but there was a lovely moment with your dad there at the weekend when he announced that he's finishing up, and I thought it was brilliant.
Yeah, it was. It was great. But yeah, look, he's finished in TV, but he enjoyed that. But he's still doing what he always wanted to do and what he always does and what he loves, and that's training racehorses. Alan, TV was a bit on the side for him, where he enjoyed
that bit on the side.
And just before we move on to our GA chat, Ruby, no one knew. Is that like he caught everyone by surprise?
A good while ago that he was, I don't know how much longer I'll do this for, but he could have said that 10 years ago too, Shane. So, you know, that's that. Make a decision. Think about someone, make a decision. Decision is made, move on.
That certainly was, and made for very nice TV. Speaking of moving on, we are going to chat GA, but just before we do, snooker gained its identity in 1875 when Neville Chamberlain, stationed in India, devised a set of rules that combined Blackpool and pyramids. The word snooker was a well-established derogatory term used to describe inexperienced or first-year military personnel, and that's where the name came from. Chamberlain made a shot who missed, played a shot, missed a pocket, and he called him a real snooker, referring to his lack of experience. So there you go.
We owe a lot to Neville Chamberlain.
Yeah, snooker being a slang term for a first-year cadet. There you go. I knew that off the top of my head.
Well done, Shane.
Marie would have known. Moving on.
Damien Lawler, talking about the Gaelic Athletic Association.
Sure, you could just ring Marie.
Brilliant, Damien.
So Damien Lawler, RTE GA reporter and presenter of the Saturday game and last weekend the Sunday game as well. I feel like I've just got it down tools here. The draw was made for the Sam Maguire Cup and the Tolchin Cup. Damien Lawler, I don't want to step on anyone's toes. You're the expert here. What happened? What should we be looking forward to?
I don't know about that, but look at the history. This follows on in the Green proposal from Congress of last year. Basically, an overwhelming cry for change, I guess, that the championship would be changed. And I think people, first time around, the cry for change reached about 50%, Shane, and then last year, with a good few tweaks, it reached 96%, and you had 70% of the GPA membership were crying out for change as well. And I suppose what was really required was something different. There was a lot of heat over keeping the provinces, particularly in the places like Ulster where the championship is thriving. That had to be factored in as well. The Super 8s previously had a lot of dead rubber, so you had to try and argue to try and exclude those as well. So bottom line, Green proposal came through Congress, 96%, basically meant that you have a league in spring. Provincial championships were kept but played in compact fashion in early summer. Provincial winners and finalists would be seeded into groups. The next places then for the top 16 of the Sam Maguire were the 8 highest placed teams in the league and the winners of last year's Tailteann Cup, which were Westmeath. And now today, before the provincial finals were played, a draw for that round-robin series took place. Groups of four were identified, four groups of four for the Sam and four groups of four for the Tailteann Cup. The winners go straight to a quarter-final of an All-Ireland. Second, third-place teams will contest the remaining four places and they'll play a preliminary All-Ireland quarter-final. So, essentially, what the GAA are trying to do is ensure that, hopefully going into the last round of games, there is still something to play for, that there's something meaningful and that there's something worthwhile as well. So today saw the draw for the inaugural round-robin All-Ireland series take place. Group 1 and Group 2 look really, really rough, lads. I'll be honest about it. Group 1 sees Mayo there. It sees Cork there. It sees the winners of Kerry and Clare. And it sees the losers of Dublin and Louth. And Group 3 is tough too. It's got the Leinster champions, the beaten Connacht finalists, and you're alongside Roscommon and Kildare. And Group 4 has the Ulster winners, the beaten Munster finalists, and Monaghan and Donegal. So it's like a little mini Ulster series there in its own. And as I said, the group winners go straight through to the quarterfinals. The others play off to see, it's like the second place teams play a third place teams in a preliminary quarterfinal, and you go from there. So I've tried to simplify it as much as I possibly can. It is exciting. However, I must say that in the group of four, you know, three teams will get out and they'll have something to go on for. So, you know, that needs probably to be looked at in time too. But I think it's a really, really good structure going forward. It's much better than what we had. Most of the time, you're going to have something to play for going into the round robin. I'll give you an example. In Tipperary, my own native county, we're in the Tailteann Cup. And in the Tailteann Cup, Tipperary have been drawn alongside Meath and Down. And Waterford. Now, Meath and Down are going to be really, really tough opponents in the Tailteann Cup. But if you can even get one win over Waterford and try and get to the third place, you're still in the mix. You can still build from there. So it is fair. It's trying to give people what they want. But the whole thing is very, very compact. There's not much room for on the fixture calendars to take a breath, to be honest about it.
So basically, 12 of the 16 teams that we're looking at in these four groups will progress to the next round. The winners are going a step ahead. Second are placed, or second are playing third, and fourth is out.
Basically. And you get a chance, Ruby, to, if you don't top your group, which a lot of teams won't, you get a chance to play maybe the third place team in another group. And by virtue of you coming second, you get home advantage. For the group phases here, each team gets one game at home. They must play one game away. And there's a neutral venue. For your own county, that's interesting, Ruby, because
surely Glenn Ryan got his wish. Surely Dublin are coming to Newbridge.
Well, Newbridge is closed.
Open it up. Can I ask Damien, technically, if Dublin win Leinster and Kildare obviously have the home fixture against Dublin, technically Kildare could nominate Croke Park, couldn't they?
It was after last Sunday, it's very unlikely that they will, Shane. But technically, of course they could.
I'd say he's more likely to nominate
to Port Leash or Tullamore.
I'd say Cullen Park and Carlow. I'd say Dr. Cullen Park would be better.
This is the thing. Like St. Conlon's Park, and you guys know this better than anybody. He's been crying out for renovation, and in fairness to the Kildare board, it took them a while to get over the line. But once they made the decision, and once the ducks were in a row, even due to the cost of inflation, they were getting at it straight away. Like, I think probably maybe possibly 6 weeks worked on it already, maybe four. But that's not going to be ready. And like, you've seen the hurling games brought out to Hawkfield, but it's going to be interesting, you know. It's going to be really, really interesting. It's just another layer to the mix. And I think when Glenn said what he said, you know, there's always a chance you're going to meet Dublin in this All-Ireland series afterwards as well. But then the other side of it too is there is, you know, Glenn is right in what he's saying. There is controversy attached to this because Dublin get to play one game at home. They get to play one game away. But the CCCC get to decide what the neutral venue is. And the chances are they will likely propose Croke Park. So you know, it will be an extra game for Dublin in Croke Park. And this is going back to...
Do we know what that game is, just to stir the pot a bit here?
I don't off the top of my head, Ruby, because I'll tell you one thing. I'm sorry I didn't do a degree in maths and logistics after today's draw, because I've a head on me going around all day trying to figure out. But just in terms of, so basically, not to be too harsh on myself, I think on May the 5th the full round of fixtures is going to be released, and we'll have a full idea there and then. But the talking points, I suppose, the stakes have been raised. There's no doubt about that. Like, I think if you look at the provincial finals, the half and all has had great luster, but now you probably are better off to win one rather than avoiding going into a certain group. There's no doubt about that. There's another talking point too, in that Jack O'Connor and Mickey Hart, you know, probably 20 years after they clashed in that Tyrone versus Kerry All Ireland series, you know, they'll meet again now in the round robin. Mickey Hart in charge of Louth this time around, you know. I think you're hopefully going to have some last day drama, and I don't know if any of you've seen the kind of the relegation, what's it called, Alan, in a rival broadcaster, it's the Survival Sunday sort of a thing.
Yeah.
You know, that could be a really huge selling point for the GAA and all of this as well. But basically, I suppose a key point in all of this, I think you're probably going to have maybe 60% more games with this new format than maybe you did around the time of 2017, pre-Super 8. So way more games, lads. There should be equality and parity across the board in most shape or forms. It's a clear mandate for change, 50% first of all, and 94.6 then at the subsequent Congress. The players on side, provincial councils happy because the provincials are retained. It will have knock-on effects down the line, there's no doubt about that. I'll be looking at next year's league. I'll be looking at the third level competitions. January, February going to be massive pressure points for anybody playing Sigerson. So that is challenges that they have to overcome, but, you know, something new and something to look forward to, I think.
I think, judging by these fixtures, Dublin against the losers of Connacht would be the neutral venue, because it's one home, one
neutral
away,
venue, yes.
One neutral. So if Dublin were, and excuse me, speaking as a Dublin man, their first game, yeah, then would be the home match. And that could be the neutral venue. But sure, we will wait to see.
It'd have to be Mullingar, wouldn't it? Halfway.
All I'm saying is Glenn Ryan should have the Dubs in Croke Park. There was only 2 points in it last time. Go again, learn from your lessons, etc. However, Ruby, you had a question there before I cut across. Yeah, apologies.
No, I'm just slagging in. I'd be heading that halfway, give the supporters a chance. Three round robin games and then a quarter final. Come on, fair is fair. Like, the
by the way,
field.
Do you guys think the football quality has improved this year?
I think this looks exciting on paper to me, Damien, when I look at these four groups, and even when I look at the Tailteann Cup, and I was watching the first round, and I think I personally would find it much more appealing to watch Meath, yeah, playing Tipperary, to watch Laois playing Offaly, than I found watching, yeah, Laois playing Dublin.
Yeah, 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 yeah. And it's about ensuring that the 16 teams that don't make the Sam Maguire Cup have a substantial a competition with meaning, and Westmeath showed it last year. They showed what it meant, and you get to play the Tailteann Cup final on an All-Ireland semi-final day. It'll be a big crowd in there. There's a big fuss about it. You know, like, it was probably the most enjoyable day I had last year was working for RT at the Tailteann Cup semi-finals. They were cracking games, and you see players like Pat Spillane Jr., for example. Pat burst on the scene. Well, I won't say burst on the scene, but Pat would have used maybe that experience with Sligo and has really developed even again this year. And players got to Croke Park and they know that, hang on, if we win the Tailteann Cup, it keeps lads at home. They don't all go to the States after losing the championship match. There is a chance of Sam Maguire in the next year's series. There's Tailteann Cup All-Stars. No, I think all the time we're getting there. Next year, I think the Hurling League will have to be re-incentivised, and I think the Football League, you're going to have to keep such a close eye on that, because if a team wants to do well in the league, they have to look after the provincial championship straight away, as Mayo found out, and then worry about peaking for this new format that we're talking about here as well, Ruby. So, look, the sports scientists will be busy. There's no doubt about that.
But you also, Damien, talk about improving teams and improving players. And I think with evenly matched teams, yeah, they will get further in the game with a chance. They will have to learn to deal with pressure late in the game, not be out of a game at half time, and that, I think, can only help to bring players forward.
Yeah, definitely. No, it's overwhelmingly positive. I think that was seen in the voting for it too. People were sick of the old format. And, you know, look, I've been talking to you guys for a number of years now on the show about the GAA, and I suppose, like, you're always trying to maybe, look, don't get me wrong, they would have been accused of being very conservative. But the rate of change has been quite impressive, actually, with all the stuff that they've introduced. It hasn't all worked now. I mean, they often have to go back and retweak it again or plant the seed and let it maybe grow slowly. But I think this one has great potential. At the very, very start of this, people said, right, this is the beginning of the end for the provincial championships. This year is definitely putting a good fight up to keep the provincial championships, you know, and there is meaning there in the seeding. And, you know, there is, as you counties like Monaghan, for example, they're not going to be automatic contenders for an All-Ireland, but they can win an Ulster title. And even to see what it meant to them beating Tyrone that day, the whole county exploded. So there is merit in keeping the provinces whilst there is a more equitable system going on around it.
Absolutely. Well, hopefully we'll make for one of the most open All-Ireland championships and indeed a very open.
It is open, definitely, yeah.
100%. Damien Lawler, thank you very much for checking in with us. We are going to take a quick break and then we're going to turn our attention to rugby with Ian Keatley.
Game on.
Rugby.
Now, you're very welcome back to Game On as we chat rugby in the company of Ian Keatley. And Ian, apologies, we were meant to get to you yesterday, but time got away from us, so we will be reflecting on a big, big weekend for Leinster. And let us start there. 41-22 winners over Toulouse, and now they are back in a Champions Cup final. What impressed you most about the manner of their victory, Ian?
Hey, Simon. Hey, Ruby. How's things? Listen, yeah, it was a great... Some matches on the weekend in both semi-finals, and yeah, starting off at Leinster, they showed their true class. They're coming up who I would have thought was a worthy match for a final pre-match, but they just executed. They got off to a slow start, obviously. Aki scoring for Toulouse first, and I thought they were going to be in trouble, but they hadn't even attacked in the first 10 minutes or so. And then established field position, got their first line out of the match, they literally looked unstoppable. Every time they entered the Toulouse 22, they came away with points. And maybe it was a bit of Toulouse shooting themselves in the foot with the yellow cards during the two yellow card periods, and they conceded 28 points. And you're already giving Leinster a leg up if they're playing against 14. It's going to be hard enough even when you're playing against 15 Leinster lads. So it was a bit of a Toulouse shooting themselves in the foot, but let's not take away from Leinster, who were classy on the day.
Wayne Barnes definitely played his part. Would you be of the opinion that the first yellow card was a yellow card, or was he really? I thought he was trying to play the ball.
Yeah, it's one of those ones. But if you go with the ball with one hand, and it was a genuine try scoring opportunity. If Ramos didn't put his hand out there, Leinster would have got down the edge and could have potentially scored. So I can see why he gave a yellow card for that. It's always the interpretation of the referee. If he was trying to catch it, did he go with her two hands? Did he knock it up or knock it down? But you kind of have to go with Wayne Barnes on that one, I think. Well, and you have to go with the 50,000 in the stadium who were screaming for yellow as well. It kind of put a bit of pressure on them to give the yellow card.
The same 50, they weren't screaming for Andrew Porter to get one.
No, not at all. I actually thought he would, like, that was not a day. And you know what, if that match was in France, I'm sure there would have been around 10 or 20 replays of that shown on the big screen, and the ref might have come back to it. But because it was in Dublin, there wasn't many replays of it.
French TV directors, bias in rugby, never heard the likes of it.
Like, what those directors are good at are showing replays of foul play and showing ladies in sunglasses on the side of the pitch.
There are some very artsy replays, to be fair, yeah, from chatting to a few VT operators who do operate there. Like, on a serious note though, would the result be much different if Toulouse had 15 men on the pitch for the full 80? Because you look at the stats of Toulouse outnumbered Leinster in carries and defenders beaten. I think their offload game was a ratio of 7-1. And when it boils down to a pair of Toulouse yellow cards resulted in 28 points for Leinster.
Yeah, it's a good question, and I honestly couldn't tell you. But like, just from being there, being at the match, when Ramos did get that yellow card, you could see the body language of the Toulouse players drop. It's like they knew, it was like, oh, here's a yellow card. We're going to be struggling here for the next 10 minutes. And within two or three phases, Leinster had scored. So like, even if you do get a yellow card, you're down to 14 men, you'd expect a bit more of a fight that you're against a little bit. So it's hard to say. It was like Leinster, whenever they wanted to, they just flicked in another gear. So I think they would have done that even with 15 men on the Toulouse field. But you just never know. But it just didn't help Toulouse. They shot themselves in the foot. And as I said, with body language and everything, they just didn't help themselves.
Ron Nogara has said over a couple of beers at the weekend he was going to devise a plan to deal with Leinster in the Champions Cup final. I would say that probably revolves around dealing with Jack Cohn, Dan Sheenan, Josh van der Vleer. How do you stop the three of those?
Do you want to just name the other 12 Leinster players that they have to stop as well? You could see early on from Toulouse the way that they were trying to defend Leinster, that they were going really hard at the Leinster breakdown. They were trying to counter-ruck. They were trying to make the ball slow down. They were trying to get hands on the ball. The referee kind of penalised them twice early on for not releasing and for not rolling away. It was like they were trying to copy the La Rochelle Leinster final from last year, because that's what La Rochelle did to Leinster last year, is they just slowed up their ball. They got in good poaching position. So I'd say if Ron Nogara, he's probably going to look at that final from last year, and I'm sure he knows well what they tried to do to them. So I'd say it is about nullifying Leinster's attack, yes. How do you do that? You have to try and slow down their ball. You have to get dominant defensive tackles. But ultimately, Leinster will create chances, and you have to have a bit of luck on the day. It's going to be a class final to see how Ronan devises his plan. But I say it'll be similar enough to last year's final.
We speak about how Ronan's going to devise a plan, but like, yes, Leinster have supreme talent and quality across the park. But La Rochelle, I mean, they are the only team to have defeated Leinster in a Champions Cup game since their quarterfinal loss against Saracens in 2020. You know, it's 12 months on from a defeat to La Rochelle in Marseille. They lost in a semi-final in 2021. So, like, I think Bernard Jackman made the point last week about the mentality, and we saw some comments from Leo Cullen coming out, and maybe they were just a bit on edge ahead of the semi-final. And yes, they've got past Toulouse. We made the point about perhaps it could have been different if Toulouse had 15 men on the pitch for 80 minutes. But like, I mean, this isn't, like, it's far from a foregone conclusion anyway, this final, and it's going to be extremely even.
It is going to be extremely even, and just let's weigh it up from the final last year. The fact that it's not in France, that has Leinster probably just a margin favourites. Of course, they're favourites because the way they've been playing, the way they did a job on Toulouse. But what you just said there, the fact that La Rochelle have beaten Leinster last year, That gives them a little bit of an advantage. No, because Leinster have this fear factor whenever they play against teams. Teams are almost going, oh, we're going to lose here. And at least La Rochelle now, they have that confidence boost from beating them in the final last year. We've beat this team. We know we can beat them. We can beat them on our day. And that will probably give them the edge. But the fact that it's probably in Dublin and you don't have... Did you see the crowd on the weekend at the La Rochelle Exeter game? Was incredible, and they just won't have that crowd behind them, which is probably just a little bit of a leveler and probably a little bit of advantage for Leinster going in.
It will be an epic encounter on Saturday, the 21st of May, I think it is, in or around then. Anyway, it's that Saturday that weekend at the Aviva Stadium. No doubt it will be a sellout. And good news for Munster today, Ian, the Tadhg Byrne is back, or looks like he'll be back for the weekend.
Yeah, Tadhg, he's been training the last couple of weeks, returning from injury, and he's got the all clear to play this weekend, which is it's a massive boost for him, for Ireland going forward, and also just for Munster this weekend, because Munster do have a tough test away to Glasgow. There's always a bit of a rivalry there that goes through the years. It's kind of good to see another rivalry, not just an inter-pro rivalry. It's good to have these rivalries that are cross the channel rivalries, and Glasgow and Munster never disappoint. And listen, Munster will probably they owe Glasgow one. They got a bit embarrassed at home to Glasgow there a few weeks ago, and there's no better way to rectify that by hopefully going over to Glasgow in Scotland Stadium and beating Glasgow away.
Are you expecting a Munster and Leinster wins then this weekend? Leinster at home to the Sharks and Munster away to Glasgow?
Listen, it's knockout rugby. It's the end of the season. It's kind of where you put yourselves into positions for finals, and it's going to be tough for both teams because Sharks are they're no pushovers either, and they're stacked with a lot of good players. We'll just see how they travel from South Africa to Ireland if they turn up. But I think the Munster Glasgow match, that's going to be tight. It's going to be physical, and it's going to go down to the wire. A lot of those Glasgow Munster matches, apart from the last one, they go down to the wire. And I remember a few years ago, Roy Scannell kicked the last minute kick to win it. I got a last minute drop goal to beat them, and they're always really tight affairs. So it's going to be a good match, physical match, and hopefully Munster come on the right end.
Yeah, it sounds like you're a training somewhere, so we won't keep you much longer. But obviously Ulster have Connacht in Belfast at the weekend as well. Mac Hansen and Bundy Aki look set to be back for Connacht, but they're going to face a tall order going to Belfast, aren't they, Connacht?
Yeah, no, it is, and Ulster will be expecting to win that on a Friday night. But I suppose the good thing for Connacht, they've found a bit of form in the last few weeks. I know they didn't win last week, but they put in a really good performance, and that was without Bundy and Mac Hansen. So they'll have Bundy and Mac back, and they just changed the whole Connacht team, especially Bundy in the midfield. Now that he's back starting for them, they've cleared up that little, I don't know, that disagreement that they had a few months back, and he looks like he's loving rugby again. And when Bundy's in form and when he's enjoying himself, Connacht are just a different animal. So it will be, I think that will also be a close match. I don't think that's a foregone conclusion. They've had a bit of close encounters throughout the years, even Connacht beating them in the Aviva there not too long back. So Connacht won't fear them going up there.
Well, it certainly should be a classic encounter. Ian Keatley, thank you very much for taking the call. And that Connacht, or Ulster Connacht match, I should say, kicks off 7:35 on Friday evening. And you can hear live commentary in a very special extended game on here on 2FM. Just a final bit of rugby news before we do take a break. The IRFU say they are in discussions with women's head coach Greg McWilliams regarding his future, but have not clarified reports that he is stepping down with immediate effect. The Irish Independent newspaper reported last night that McWilliams will depart his role after Ireland finished bottom of the Women's Six Nations. The former Irish assistant replaced Adam Griggs as head coach in January of 2022, with Ireland winning just three of his 12 games to date in charge, the most recent victory coming on the summer tour of Japan last year. McWilliams, who was under contract until the end of 2023, is believed to have informed members of the squad that he is stepping aside immediately, while the positions of senior coach John McKee and assistants Niamh Briggs and Dennis Fogarty are still unclear. So, Sinead, for rugby, we're going to be chatting soccer in a few moments' time with Mark Langdon and Alan Colley.
Game on.
Football.
Welcome back to Game On. So Alan Colley is in studio. Mark Langdon joins us on the line. And I suppose, Mark Langdon, I think we should start with Sam Allardyce going back to Leeds United. Can he keep them afloat? Or will he even go back there?
Will he keep Leeds afloat? I'm looking at their fixtures. I would say it's going to be very difficult, for whoever were to come in and replace Javier Garcia. It's difficult. I'm looking and thinking, well, Manchester City away, don't see anything there. You can't really see, I don't think, anything in the away games. You've got West Ham, home to Tottenham. I think it's going to be difficult to see Leeds getting another, say, 3 or 4 points this season, and that could be the difference between staying up and being relegated. I think the whole club's in a mess at the moment. Recruitment has been way off what you'd expect of a top flight team. Made so many mistakes on transfers. They under Bielsa, they knew exactly the way they were going to play. It was easier to buy players on the back of that. They decided to move away from it. Went to Jesse Marsh. Not all Leeds fans enjoyed his tactics, and that's their right, I suppose. But at least there was a plan and a process when Marsh was there. Under Garcia, I wasn't entirely sure what they were trying to do. They weren't threatening going forward. They looked like they were going to concede too many goals. We know Allardyce will tighten them up defensively, but we've seen with Sean Dyche coming in at Everton, there's no magic kind of touch to keeping a team in the Premier League. I think it depends largely on what players you've got, and those Leeds ones don't really look good enough at the moment.
Director of football Victor Orta has also left the club by mutual consent. I mean, if Gracia goes, it'll be a record extending 15th managerial departure in the Premier League this season, which is just staggering. But like, Alan, how do you go from Bielsa ball to former England and Limerick FC manager Sam Allardyce?
It just goes to show the mismanagement at the club, Shane, in terms of the planning. There is no planning. There's no structure, because when you're appointed managers with no plan, and as you said, they had a clear identity under Bielsa. Now, obviously, that ended where they had to sack him in the end. But then you're literally contrasting going from one to the other, and Jesse Marsh come in, and then you have Grazia, and you look at the concession of goals as well, and that's what's going to kill them in terms of staying them up. They've conceded 67 goals. You look at even their last five or six games, 5 against Crystal Palace, 6 against Liverpool, 4 at the weekend. Now, if there's one thing Sam Allardyce is very good at, as we all know, it's putting a defensive structure into a team and an organisation, so that will give them some chance. But it's just pure desperation at this stage, because obviously they just want to stay in the Premier League by hook or by crook, and he has a good record in doing that, Allardyce, in terms of being very defensive with that structure, and he will do that. To be fair to him, you have to give him credit for that. But it's just the whole club, as Mark rightly says, is an absolute mess from top to bottom, off the pitch as well, and it's hard to see them staying up even if Allardyce comes in.
Did last night's result do Leeds a favour, perhaps, Mark? Leicester City 2, Everton 2?
It certainly didn't do them any harm. I think that all the teams down the bottom would have been cheering on a draw. And the way that the game was played, it didn't look like either team wanted a draw. It was a chaotic clash, wasn't it? And could have gone either way. But I think that both teams tried to win, and that showed you that a point wasn't a great result for either team. I'm looking at sort of Leicester, and they've got, it still feels like they've got quality in Vardy and in Maddison and in Barnes and Tillemans to keep them up. I feel like I've said that for 34 games this season, that eventually it's going to come right. I still feel like, they've got a class edge over some of those other teams that, I look at Leeds, I'm not sure where the kind of inspiration will come from. At least with Leicester, I see Vardy and I see Maddison, and I like the look of those two. Everton, with Dominic Calvert-Lewin back, that was probably as lively as they've looked up front for a while, actually. So that gives them hope as well. They've got Bournemouth at home, haven't they, on the final day of the season. So, look, Bournemouth have done brilliantly, but by then you'd hope they'd be safe, and they might be thinking there's 3 points for them. But like Leeds, they otherwise got a very difficult running. I like the look of Leicester's games more than I do Everton, I think.
Speaking of leaders, for anyone that didn't witness the match last night, Jamie Coleman went off with a very, very bad injury. He was stretchered off. There's no news on how serious the injury is, but for anyone who didn't witness it, Alan, to see him being stretchered off, but he was still geeing up the crowd, geeing up his players. Like, the man's in clear agony here, yet he's still trying to be that leader, that captain. Like, that's just phenomenal.
Yeah, and you can't earn that, Shane, in terms of, like, or get that from training or practice. That's in you or it's not. And Seamus has always been like that. And he's an inspirational captain, inspirational person. He's a brilliant lad as well, as everybody knows. He's been such a brilliant servant to Everton. Everybody loves him. When you consider the money that he cost as well, going over from Sligo Rovers, it's incredible the service that he's given them. And it was just such a shame, because he's been playing really well. Like, we were probably, and obviously we have a view on the international team, and probably about 18 months ago, 2 years ago, we probably would have been writing Seamus off, in the sense that Matt Doherty was playing quite well and he would have been ahead of him in the pecking order, and we were thinking it might be hard for Seamus to continue as a starter, a number one starter kind of in the international team. But the last 18 months he's been absolutely brilliant, and certainly this season as well, since he got himself back to full fitness. And he's a real inspirational figure, so he'll be a blow as well to Everton, because it did look like a nasty injury. He'll be trying to inspire them from behind the scenes as a good captain and a good person that he is, but it's just such a shame because, as I say, he's been doing really well. And even for us with the games coming up in the summer, Seamus would feature in those games, I think, because, as I say, it's not just us kind of looking at him thinking, oh yeah, well, we love Seamus anyway, and kind of looking at it blindly. He's been playing really, really well. So I think it's a huge blow for Everton, and I think they're doomed as well. You're asking Mark there in terms of who'll go down. I think Leeds will go, and Everton and Southampton. I think Forest might sneak out of it.
Obviously, guys, tonight Arsenal, if they have any chance of keeping the pressure on Man City, they're going to have to beat Chelsea. And Mark, reading your own Racing Post today, the key stat is that Arsenal have picked up the same number of points at home as Chelsea have, both home and away.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a shocking season for Chelsea. I don't think anybody could have predicted that they would be bottom half of the Premier League, and that was before they spent the amount of money they did in January. Can't buy a goal, never mind a win at the moment. Obviously, Frank Lampard is being heavily criticised for, you know, not being able to pick up this team, but I think a lot of it comes down to the players and their attitude. Sort of stinks really at the moment. They know that Lampard won't be there next season, so he can't really affect the dressing room at this stage. The players need to do it for themselves, and at the moment they don't seem to be that bothered either way, which is probably damning indictment of sort of some of those characters that have been bought in to the club. And if it is to be Maurizio Pochettino that arrives in the summer, he's got a lot of work to do, I think, to build a harmony within that dressing room. There's no doubt about the talent. I mean, ordinarily, you know, they've got a good record in over sort of the Premier League era against Arsenal, the type of team that's caused them many issues. But at the moment, the two teams look, just in completely different places. The one thing you would say about Arsenal, though, is defensively, they've not been very good in recent weeks, and that needs to change. You can't keep on conceding early goals. You can't concede three goals at home to Southampton and realistically hope to win the Premier League. So they need to tighten up at the back. Easier said than done with Saliba not playing. But Arsenal over the course of the season have been miles ahead of Chelsea. And if they play to their best, they should win tonight.
It will be interesting to see if Chelsea can have another say in the title race. This day 7 years ago, Chelsea drew with Tottenham 2-2, which gave Leicester City their first top flight title. So Chelsea sneak a result here could be good night Arsenal.
Yeah, well, it's just purely for their own reasons that they need the result. I think it's good night Arsenal anyway. Arsenal have blown a chain over the last kind of 2 or 3 weeks, and even if you look at the fixtures, obviously Chelsea tonight, then they have Newcastle who are flying, and Brighton after that. I just think it's too big of an ask now, especially with the games in hand City have as well, and the form that they're in. So I think for Chelsea tonight, it's all about them. And as Mark said, the players, Frank Lampard's obviously getting a lot of stick and he'll want to win, but the players as well need to show some professional pride. And how often have we said that about certain individuals and certain players? You could throw Spurs into the mix, Leeds players as well. Like, there's a real attitude problem with a lot of these lads, and I'm not sure how you fix it, but a new manager needs to come in at Chelsea and really get to grips with that dressing room, because the culture seems all wrong at the moment. And maybe there's just too many players, too many egos, too much money, all those kind of things that are factoring into the shambles that it is at the moment. But I think Arsenal will win tonight, probably against Chelsea, but I still think it's too late.
So, well, speaking of Arsenal, heartbreaking for Katie McCabe and Arsenal last night. She was captain of Arsenal. They went out in extra time to Wolfsburg in the Champions League semi-final, 5-4 in aggregate, the final score there, in a sold out Emirates Stadium, 60,000 fans, which was great to see, because the same fixture 10 years ago had just over 1,000 fans present for Arsenal Wolfsburg in the semi-final. So it's great to see that growth. Speaking of Katie McCabe, the Ireland women's national team were drawn into Group B1 in League B for the inaugural version of the UEFA Women's Nations League. Ireland's involvement in the competition will kick off in September with two games before, two more in October, and then a final two games in November. They were drawn against Northern Ireland, Hungary and Albania. Mark Langdon, we usually get you to explain the Nations League, but I think we've a couple of minutes left in the show. We'd probably need a couple of hours. I suppose the crux of it is there's more competitive games for Ireland, and indeed that's just going to grow the squad. And it's a positive thing.
Yeah, I think so. You know, you want to be playing at teams at your kind of level. I think that's been a positive of the Nations League in the men's game, and it will be in the women's. You know, I think in terms of the women's sport, they're still looking to try to, you know, to build it. And the only way you do that is by playing games, getting the exposure, you know, bringing the stars out and sort of, you know, people going to watch them or, you know, listen to it on the radio or watch it on TV. So, you know, play as many games as you can and at a level where, you know, you're not going to get sort of thrashed, but also you're not going to start beating teams by wide margins. And I think that's probably one of the next steps for women's football, is to try to bring the depth and the level up, and competitions like this, I think, can only really help in that regard.
Time is against us, Alan Colley, but I do want to mention Tim Clancy gone from St. Pat's. John Daly's the interim manager. He'll take charge on Friday against Cork. Are you surprised by the news?
Not really, because the murmurings around, I suppose, Tim over the last kind of 4 or 5 weeks have been that he's under a bit of pressure. Obviously, he kind of staved that off for a period when he got the 4 wins in a row. But the 4 wins, 3 of them were against teams you'd expect him to beat: UCD, Cork and Drogheda. So the run of fixtures was kind to him. But you look at the last 3 fixtures, they've lost, and particularly the 2 over the weekend. Obviously, Friday night losing to Derry. Yesterday, they lost to Sligo Rovers as well. So I'm not all that surprised. Do I think it was a little bit premature? Probably, but I'm not all that surprised because of the murmurings that was coming around Tim. So yeah,
okay, well, it'll be interesting to see where next for St. Pat's. Ruby, that's all we have time for, isn't it?
It is indeed, Shane. Thank you very much for your company, and to you, Alan Colley. It was an enjoyable show. Better De Silva's up next. Enjoy the rest of your week. RTE 2FM.